One advised Korean army forces in the province. Another oversaw unilateral operations and was isolated from every South Vietnamese agency, all of which were penetrated by the VCI. The POIC spent most of his time with the unilateral operations officer, a veteran who had over 20 years of spy experience. Simmons was a low man on the totem pole, and his boss gave him little supervision. He was, after all, working with counterparts who were not trusted. "We met and we talked," Simmons explained. "But the POIC focused on the unilateral operations guy, on political reporting, on dissident groups, who was running in elections, who was going to win." The third officer advised the PIC chief and vacated Vietnam soon after Simmons arrived. He was not replaced due to the reduction in forces policy in place, and Simmons inherited the thankless job. But all was not doom and gloom. "In late 1970, Simmons said, "there was a feeling that we were winning the war, not conquering Hanoi, not pacifying the countryside, but reducing the VCI threat and driving the NVA main forces back." Simmons's job involved intelligence and paramilitary operations. In regard to intelligence, he directed Special Police Chief Tam in operations designed to identify members of the VCI, with the goal of controlling the political environment by penetrating the VCI. This was not an easy thing to do. Those in GVN-controlled areas had cover jobs, doctor, teacher, farmer, while filling positions within the insurgency, such as messenger to VCI in the hamlets and villages. Those in the countryside were armed and hiding in secret lairs. Knowing how the CIA worked with the special police in Vietnam is helpful in understanding how the CIA operates in Afghanistan, Iraq, and elsewhere. As recently as May 2016, the Pentagon announced that dozens of American advisors had been deployed to Yemen over the past 2 weeks. They are working with Saudi and Arab coalition troops seeking to assert control over southern portions of the country, including the areas controlled by Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, AQAP. As noted, CIA advisors like Simmons often work under military cover. Today, in Yemen and elsewhere, they are doing exactly what he did. More to the point, the CIA funds, equips, and manages the special police forces it has created worldwide, but you won't hear about it on the news. In Vietnam, the CIA organized the special police into sections. At the top was the chief, and under him were, among others, an interrogation section, a studies and plans section, and the all-important Secret Services section, SSS. The SSS was split into two subsections. The first would watch, track, arrest, and recruit low-level VCI sympathizers. The more important Special Operations subsection ran infiltration and penetration operations. Because Special Operations involved strategic intelligence, the special police chief jointly supervised SSS cases with his CIA advisor, who met directly with and helped the SSS case officers running agents in the field. Agent recruitment was compartmentalized. When the special police spotted an insider who could be recruited to infiltrate the VCI, or an outsider in a position to approach members of the VCI, the first step was to determine if he/she could be turned into an agent. What did he do? Did she live in the area where the VCI were operating? Did the person have contact with someone inside the VCI? Such a person was known as a PIRL, a potential intelligence recruitment lead. If he or she were found to be suitable, they were recruited. Next, the special police drafted a preliminary plan to train the recruit in tradecraft, how to collect information, what matters to focus on, how to maintain a cover story, and how to make contact with and secretly report to a case officer. All of this was discussed with a CIA advisor. If a CIA advisor like Simmons approved the plan, he dipped into his black bag and supplied the cash to pay the agent. He also provided the necessary equipment, cameras, tape recorders, safe houses, and items like antibiotics to purchase the target's cooperation. The special police chief, SSS chief, and SSS case officer would periodically meet with the CIA advisor to evaluate the agent's information report. When things were running smoothly, an operational plan was made. If the agent succeeded in transforming himself into a VC activist, the plan was upgraded to an infiltration plan. If the agent succeeded in turning a VCI cadre into a defector, a spy inside the VCI, the plan reached its highest level and became a penetration plan. At that point, and this is the crucial part, the running of the operation was turned over to the CIA, and the special police were ordered to protect, maintain, and not interfere in the plan. In every case, the special police had to follow the CIA advisor's directions and satisfy his every need. This involved a significant degree of humiliation, for CIA advisors like Simmons rarely spoke Vietnamese, and even with a translator, they could not comprehend the subtleties of Vietnamese culture, let alone the intricacies of a penetration operation, which is why neither party trusted the other. Within this perverse environment, a CIA officer like Simmons was constantly asserting his dominance, and misunderstandings and resentments proliferated. Inevitably, CIA officers like Simmons internalized yet another integral part of the hero myth, the Lord Jim warlord mentality. Megalomaniacal warlords intriguing against one another to control the political environment is the dynamic that defines America's hidden corridors of power. Phoenix in Fujian. The special police sent a representative to the Fujian Province Phoenix / Phung Hong Committee, along with information and documents from its Studies and Plans section. But they did not direct the committee or its field operations. Consequently, Simmons considered Phoenix a duplication of special police operations. The special police might send reports to the Phoenix Center, he observed, which was out on point, not downtown, and consisted of a bunch of people keeping files. Just as the CIA knew that the VCI had penetrated the special police, so too the special police knew that Phoenix had been penetrated. Phoenix was more exposed and an easier target of enemy collection efforts. In Fujian province, the Phoenix DOICCs were often attacked and files stolen. "We would go to Phoenix and they'd show us a file," Simmons said, "and we'd use the file to help build a case. Every report we generated, we sent to the PIOCC. But Special Branch had its own files, and if at the PIC we got someone who cooperated, we would withhold his file if he was going to be doubled, because we knew the PIOCC was penetrated." Simmons and the PRU. By 1971, the CIA was distancing itself from its PRU counter-terror teams, as well as from Phoenix and the Special Branch. Simmons was never responsible for the PRU. He knew the South Vietnamese PRU chief, whom he described as a smart, upstanding, responsible guy, and he allowed the PRU to use his radio, but that was the extent of his involvement. According to Simmons, the Phoenix coordinator in Fujian province worked more closely with the PRU than he did. The PRU, when developing information on VCI cadre in a village or hamlet, would acquire targeting information from the DIOCCs. The PRU would ask, "Who do you have in that village?" And then the PRU chief would check out the DIOCC's files on likely candidates. The region's PRU advisor, Jack Harrell, had attended the same CIA training class as Simmons. Harrell paid the PRU once a month out of the CIA's bottomless black bag. 30 years later, Simmons would call upon Harrell to support the story he told to the New London Day that no one was ever tortured at the Fujian PIC. Harrell went along with the fiction. Simmons and the PIC. Under Simmons's supervision, the special police placed suspected members of the VCI, including children, on a blacklist. If they appeared to act suspiciously or were accused by an informer, they were snatched and placed in the PIC. Simmons was involved at every stage of every operation. The PIC was a one-story building with a tin roof in downtown Tuy Ho. Simmons's office was around the corner in a Quonset hut on the grounds of the National Police Station. His translator had good relations with the PIC chief An interrogation section officer who reported to the special police chief and to Tran Quang Nam, the ranking national police chief in the province. Simmons described the PIC chief as smart, educated, from Saigon, a progressive. The PIC chief's staff provided reports for Simmons to peruse. After reading the translated reports, Simmons would interrogate prisoners who, in his estimation, could become penetration agents. He conducted the interrogations himself, but he emphasized he never let himself get in untenable situations. The PIC chief did not manage penetration operations. He helped the SSS case officer interrogate and single out leads for the special police chief to exploit. But Simmons was a control freak and considered the PIC the key place for recruiting double agents. The PICs, like almost every CIA operation, were kept secret from the American public, but were a grim reality, like U.S. military bases, to the people living around them. The PICs were notorious, and South Vietnamese citizens were constantly complaining about them. Theoretically, a PIC advisor played a mediating role with the local population. While staying in the shadows, he helped improve conditions in response to citizen complaints for more light, more windows, more water, more space, more food and medicine. This public relations consideration was the reason why Simmons had access to Vietnamese medics and, in rare instances, American doctors. PICs were also a way station. Prisoners were supposed to be rotated out within a few days and their cases sent to Province Security Committees, PSC, for disposal. If enough evidence was presented to convict someone as a national security offender, he/she was placed in administrative detention without access to a lawyer or due process. There were detention centers in every province, apart from the PICs and prisons. This same system exists in every nation America currently occupies. Private U.S. companies make out like bandits building the facilities. High-level VCI were sent to the National Interrogation Center in Saigon. People convicted of national security offenses were sent to various prisons or the infamous facility at Con Son Island, where they were stuck and often shackled in tiger cages. Rows of submerged concrete cells shaped like coffins, built by French colonialists with iron gates for roofs so that guards could look down on the prisoners from above, whose existence was revealed to the public by Don Luce in 1970. The Special Intelligence Force Unit. The PRU teams were controversial and known for war crimes. Called the CIA's hired killers by journalist Georgie Ann Geyer in a 1970 article for True magazine. The PRU were recruited by CIA talent scouts from Vietnam's minority ethnic and social groups. PRU teams were composed of Chinese Nungs, Montagnards, Muslim Chams, Cambodians, convicts, and former VC. The one thing they had in common was the ability to kill without remorse. By 1971, the CIA was distancing itself from the PRU, and Simmons was instructed to develop his own paramilitary unit for capturing and killing individual VCI. As a trained paramilitary officer, he was fully prepared and willing to mount operations designed to kill targeted members of the VCI. During our interview in 1988, Simmons produced reports of his paramilitary operations in Fujian province. One report told how a special police team killed three VCI in November 1970. Based on a tip provided by an informer, the VCI were ambushed at night while digging a spider hole outside Vinh Phu Hamlet. One of the people killed, Nguyen Van Thon, was described in the report as the secretary of the Communist Party Chapter Committee and chairman of the Village People's Revolutionary Committee. Thon was 20 years old and a native of Vinh Phu Hamlet. He was killed in his neighborhood. As a result of this successful operation, Simmons was ordered to develop the province's paramilitary capability. To that end, he created one of several prototypes for special action teams in Military Region 2. Called the Special Intelligence Force Unit, SIFU, it was formed in late 1971. Recruits came from nearby districts. All were volunteers from the Special Police and the National Police Field Forces. Eventually, there were six teams, each consisting of four men from the Special Police and four from the Field Forces. The Fujian Province SIFU had its own facility and was commanded by Special Force Officer Nguyen Van Ki. It was advised and funded by Rob Simmons. Simmons did not say if he accompanied the SIFU team on its missions, but in order to command respect, CIA paramilitary officers routinely went on missions. In a report dated December 1971, the National Police Commander in Fujian Province discussed several SIFU operations. Simmons objected to the word assassinate, so Colonel Nam used the word exterminate to describe a mission in which two VCI were killed in an ambush. As an example of SIFU effectiveness, Simmons produced a copy of a 29 January 1972 letter he sent to his CIA superiors. The letter was a request for medals for SIFU members who had participated in the recent Lien Tri operation. The Lien Tri operation began when an informer reported that elements of the Tui Ho City Party Committee Action Team were planning to enter Lien Tri Hamlet to build hiding places in preparation for an attack against Tui Ho and its northern suburbs. The North Vietnamese were at the time laying the groundwork for the spring offensive of 1972. The SIFU moved into the area the following day to intercept the VC action team. At 9 p.m., four confirmed VC, along with three women and seven youths, were seen digging a hole and were taken under fire. Killed were Trinh Tan Luc, a Tui Ho Party Committee member, and Nguyen Dung of the Tui Ho Current Affairs Committee. Under laws written by Americans, it was legal for Simmons to target for death South Vietnamese civilians, such as the three women and seven youths digging the hole. Given that two of the VCI had organized a recent attack on Tui Ho, Simmons was pleased to exterminate them. The operation was over by 11 p.m. This operation epitomizes the type of operation we encouraged the police to run against the VC/VCI in Fujian Province, Simmons boasted to his boss. The special police prepared detailed information on the individual VC, tasked their local sources for information on the individuals targeted, which was of immediate value, and then were able to mount a strike force which was sufficiently well-equipped to effectively react to the information in a timely manner. The results speak for themselves. Prior to leaving Vietnam in June 1972, Simmons conducted one last operation. That spring, the NVA and VCI had attacked the Fujian PIC and CIA compound. Binh Dinh Province, bordering Fujian on the north, was overrun by enemy forces, which were advancing on Tui Ho when Simmons leaped into action. Everyone was in a panic. For several harrowing days, they were cut off from the rest of Region 2. Simmons spent a night alone in the compound monitoring the radio, and the next day, after crawling out from under his desk, he helped move reinforcements and supplies across the beachhead. It was touch and go, and after the main attack was repulsed, Simmons and his homeboys were confronted with a dicey situation. Thousands of refugees were fleeing Binh Dinh, and the VCI were using them as cover to sneak in their own assassins. CIA officers had been targeted for assassination, a word Simmons uses when people target Americans, in Binh Dinh, and reports indicated that the CIA officers in Fujian were next on the list. The fear and apprehension were palpable, but Simmons saved the day. Documents captured in March revealed that the VCI were planning to infiltrate Tui Ho in minivans called Lambros. So, Simmons explained, we rolled the Lambro drivers up and we put them all in the PIC. That's 15 to 20 people. We interrogated the Lambro drivers and learned they had all been conscripted. They were bringing VC cadres posing as farmers into Tui Ho. The Lambros were driven by VCI, including a few women. They had weapons hidden under seats to attack government offices. As Simmons is fond of saying, the results speak for themselves. But is there another side of the story of his CIA activities in Vietnam? What did the South Vietnamese and their government, which the U.S. was ostensibly there to support, think of his operations? Mythological transformations.
I'm a poor farm girl, Simmons said in a shrill falsetto voice, mocking a woman he'd snatched and confined without due process in the PIC.
So we released her and watched her for 3 months. Then we put her name in the paper. Arresting and watching her suppressed her and the organization, too. What Simmons described is the application of terror to suppress people. He traveled 12,000 miles to terrorize and kill Vietnamese citizens like 20-year-old Nguyen Van Thon in their backyards because they believed in agrarian reform and resisted foreign domination. As an exceptional American, he did so unflinchingly under the pretext of bringing self-determination to the Vietnamese. Meanwhile, some of the communist sympathizers he terrorized were, despite his best efforts, being freely elected into public office as part of the ceasefire agreements. Although Simmons would insist that PICs and PRUs were synonymous with democratic institutions, many South Vietnamese disagreed. As early as June 1969, South Vietnam's National Assembly had questioned the Ministers of Defense, Justice, and Interior about abuses by Phoenix officials, including illegal arrest, torture, and corruption. 86 deputies signed a petition asking for an explanation. Justice Minister Le Van Thieu noted that the extra-legal facet of the system, the province security committees, had the power to sentence VCI cadre for up to 2 years in detention without convicting them of any crime. Thieu said the practical difficulties of amassing solid evidence made it necessary to arrest everyone suspected of complicity. That explanation was not well received. One legislator charged the Vinh Binh province police chief with knowingly arresting innocent people for the purpose of extortion. Another said VCI suspects were detained for 6 to 8 months before their cases were heard, and that suspects were frequently tortured to extract confessions. She said the people hated the GVN for starting Phoenix. Other deputies were incensed that American troops forcefully and illegally detained suspects during military operations, a charge Colby would deny at congressional hearings in 1971. Congressman Reed asked Colby, "Do Phoenix advisors perform any actual arrests or killings, or do they merely select the individuals who are to be placed on the list who are subject to killing or capturing and subsequent sentencing?" Colby replied, "They certainly do not arrest, because they have no right to arrest." But he added speciously, "Occasionally a police advisor may go out with a police unit to capture somebody, but he would not be the man who reached out and grabbed the fellow." At the same hearings, Army Intelligence Officer Michael Yule testified that all civilian detainees were listed as VCI and that despite Colby's denials, Americans exercised power of arrest over Vietnamese citizens. In Duc Pho, Yule said, where the 11th Brigade base camp was located, "we could arrest and detain at will any Vietnamese civilian we desired, without so much as a whisper of coordination with ARVN or GVN authorities. As for the accuracy of information from paid sources who could easily have been either provocateurs or opportunists with a score to settle," Yule said, "the unverified and in fact unverifiable information nevertheless was used regularly as input to artillery strikes, harassment and interdiction fire, B-52s and other airstrikes, often on populated areas." No Vietnamese citizen was fooled by Colby's double talk. Grassroots opposition to American occupation and systematic repression existed and was not confined to communists. At Senate hearings held in 1970, Foreign Relations Committee Chairman William Fulbright asked Colby, "Where is Mr. Truong Dinh Zhu, the man who ran second in the last election?" "Mr. Zhu is in Chi Ho Jail in Saigon," Colby said, adding that Zhu was not arrested under Phoenix, but under Article 4, which made it a crime to propose the formation of a coalition government with the communists. Apart from Colby and his co-conspirators, no one made a distinction between Vietnamese officials the Americans corrupted, or the Americans advising Phoenix, or the ubiquitous American-created and jerry-rigged judicial system that enabled all the atrocities that occurred. For its part, the CIA lumped together peaceniks, neutralists, and political opponents as VCI, but again, the Vietnamese people weren't fooled. They knew the CIA didn't want to end the war if it meant sharing power with communists. As it is in Afghanistan today, the CIA's goal in Vietnam was to prevent rapprochement, which it tried to do by making advocating peace with the communists punishable by death or imprisonment without trial under the An Tri laws. Despite the Vietnamese people's efforts at political accommodation, the CIA in 1972 still considered neutralists and anyone advocating peace as legitimate targets for extermination. And Congressman Rob Simmons was an agent of this genocidal endeavor to suppress the will of the Vietnamese people to live in peace. The same can be said of the American militants who lead America into war after war in Islamic states, pushing young Muslim men into fundamentalism and provoking within them the lust for revenge that our leaders then insidiously use as a pretext to restrict civil liberties and institute a police state in the U.S. Being in Simmons's presence was disturbing, the way being around CIA officers always is. One senses that the abuse they have heaped on their victims has forever warped their souls. They no longer need to psych themselves up to dehumanize their imaginary enemies. It's second nature to them. My argument to the New London Day was that it is necessary to ask how Simmons's prolonged abuse of people affected him and those like him, and how their sick sensibilities might determine their actions if they moved from clandestine operations into public office. The newspaper dismissed my argument as irrelevant, but the detrimental effects of engaging in torture are known. In December 2014, the Washington Post cited from the Senate report on CIA torture. The report said that numerous CIA agents engaged in torture in Iraq and around the world had serious documented personal and professional problems that should have called into question their employment by the CIA and access to classified information. The author of the article asked, "What can we expect for the future of those who carried out the rectal feedings, waterboardings, and other harsh treatment of detainees that the report described?" I was muzzled in 2000 when Simmons was running for Congress, but time has justified my fears that the public embrace of Simmons and those like him represented a dangerous drift toward fascism in America. Indeed, he and his CIA co-conspirators have applied the same tactics they used in South Vietnam against their liberal enemies in America, as I shall demonstrate later in this book. When I asked Simmons about the morality of interrogation centers and hit teams, he said, "Most of what we did was benign." He assumed no responsibility. He admitted only to negligent cruelties, and thanks to CIA secrecy, there is no official evidence to contradict him. But there is circumstantial evidence. Residual responsibility. When The Day ran its feature article on Simmons, it avoided the overarching issue of American responsibility for systematic repression in Vietnam and focused solely on Simmons's good intentions. In support of Simmons's claim, it cited Gary Maddox, who managed the CIA's PRU teams in Four Corps in 1971. Maddox, whose CIA escapades are chronicled in a prior chapter, said he visited Simmons and never observed any torture at the PIC. He qualified that statement, however, by adding, "Our orders were to vacate the premises if anybody was being mistreated, but we couldn't tell them what to do. They ran the show." Maddox's statement, "they ran the show," is patently untrue, and while The Day let it stand, there is plenty of evidence to prove it is false. The special police were well aware of who ran the show. One of the top special police officers told me that his organization, along with the entire South Vietnam government, was like a needy person, and any gift given to her or him was precious and heartily welcomed. Every year, the gifts were newer and better than before, and so the government willingly followed whatever directions and instructions accompanied the gifts. The special police officer quoted a proverb used in South Vietnamese financial circles, a proverb that applied when CIA promises were accompanied by action, meaning money. "Who pays, governs." Simmons admitted as much. When I interviewed him in 1988, I asked about his relationship with his counterparts. He replied that the PIC chief reported administratively up through the police structure, but he also knows that the building was built by the CIA and then turned over. Okay, but he also knows that, hey, you know this building came from the guy in the Quonset hut. I asked if the CIA paid special branch salaries. "That's right," he replied. and also the agents. If you've got a hot agent that you want to recruit, the money comes from the CIA. I was very interested in some of the quality of interrogation that was going on, Simmons added, and I had access to resources so that I could manage phone rings, so that I could get what I wanted. Simmons could get anything he wanted, and as we know, he who pays governs. In a letter to the editor, I suggested that if the Day really wanted to confirm, as the editor had said, that Simmons was a good public figure with clean hands, it should send a reporter to Vietnam to interview any surviving civilians who had been held in the Phuyen PIC while it was under Simmons' supervision. Get the other side of the story, I suggested. Let the victims be the judges. But the newspaper preferred the Homeric myths about Simmons, whom it endorsed. It never sent anyone to Vietnam. It didn't even try to contact knowledgeable Vietnamese officials and historians. There are, however, contemporaneous reports regarding conditions in the PICs. One of them is a 9 September 1973 letter from David and Jane Barton to Congressman Robert N.C. Nix at the Asian and Pacific Affairs Subcommittee. From May 1971 until May 1973, the Bartons were field directors with the American Friends Service Committee's Rehabilitation Center in Quang Nai Province. Quang Nai is close to Phuyen, and what the Bartons said about the Quang Nai PIC mirrored events in the PIC supervised by Simmons. I'll cite portions of their letter to give a sense of what went on. The Bartons addressed the withholding of medicine as a torture technique. They noted that medical care for prisoners was almost non-existent. During their 2 years in Quang Nai, they said, no Vietnamese doctor nor medical person visited any of the prisoners, and there were few medicines stronger than aspirin. Prisoners were seriously ill with, among other things, pneumonia, onset broken bones, infected wounds, and malnutrition. Some were chained to their beds, and prison officials rarely isolated prisoners with communicable diseases such as tuberculosis. A second problem, they said, was that many prisoners in the hospital were returned to the PIC for further interrogation, even though they were diagnosed as seriously ill and under treatment. One such example is that of a 19-year-old woman whom our doctor discovered had a cardiovascular problem of potentially serious consequences. In addition, the patient had a 3-month-old fractured femur due to a bullet wound and was unable to walk. The AFSO doctor asked both the American and Vietnamese officials to allow him to remove the bullet and evaluate this prisoner's heart condition. The American and Vietnamese officials were fully aware of the danger to this prisoner's life if she did not receive medical treatment, and yet she was returned to the interrogation center and denied medical care. On the subject of torture in PICs, they wrote, the majority of the prisoners to whom we gave medical treatment had been tortured. We were able to gather evidence of torturing through the physical examination, through interviews and personal accounts, and from x-rays and photographs. During interrogation at the Province Interrogation Center, prisoners explained that they are forced to drink large amounts of water mixed with lime, soap, or salty fish sauce. After their stomachs are bloated, the interrogator jumps on their stomachs. One APSO doctor examined several patients who had petit mal seizures and memory lapses. He felt that this was due to brain damage caused by drinking such toxins. Prisoners also told an AFSO doctor that they were forced to lie on a table, and if they didn't respond to questioning properly, the investigator would reach underneath their rib cage and crack or break the prisoner's rib. The same doctor examined and had x-ray evidence of several prisoners with cracked or broken ribs. Frequently, prisoners suffered from internal bleeding and internal injuries. These prisoners described how they were placed upright in water-filled oil drums, which were then beaten on the sides, giving the prisoners internal injuries without leaving external marks of torture on their bodies. Many prisoners showed very visible signs of being beaten, and in several cases, skull fractures, brain hemorrhages, and various forms of paralysis resulted. Prisoners were also tortured with electricity. Electrical wires were attached to their toes, fingers, or genitals. When the electrical shocks were administered, they would become unconscious. Upon regaining consciousness, the prisoners would again be interrogated, and if their interrogators were not satisfied with their answers, the electrical shocks would be repeated. The electrical torturing seemed to cause strange physiological phenomenon, fits and seizures, especially among the female prisoners. We knew as many as 25 women who routinely had 8 to 10 such seizures a day. During our routine medical visits with prisoners, we were able to witness and document the permanent mental and physical damage which prisoners sustained as a result of the tortures mentioned above. Ultimately, the Bartons were trying to convince Congress to stop funding the systematic political repression it imposed on the Vietnamese. To that end, they said, "We were distressed to hear stories of torture going on in the American-built interrogation center, and to see men and women, rice farmers from the Quang Nai countryside, continually being arrested and transported there in American-purchased vehicles. Similarly, it was upsetting to speak with a Vietnamese national police commander who had been trained at the U.S. International Police Academy, and to discover that this official expected a large bribe from us for the release of the brother of one of our Vietnamese staff. Incidents such as these were just a few of the constant superficial reminders of how American money and supplies were being used to mistreat and imprison Vietnamese civilians." Based on reports of torture in PICs, Congressman Paul McCloskey visited Vietnam in early 1971. While there, he asked CIA officer John Mason, the director of the Phoenix program, to arrange a visit to a PIC. It wasn't easy getting in. McCloskey was met at the gate by a red-headed CIA officer with a revolver on each hip, cowboy style. A combat veteran of Korea, McCloskey brushed him aside and pushed his way in. To its credit, the day cited McCloskey as saying, "There were instruments of torture in the interrogation room, whips and manacles, things of that nature." The day did not add that upon returning to the U.S., McCloskey and several colleagues stated their belief that torture is a regularly accepted part of interrogation, and that U.S. civilian and military personnel have participated for over 3 years in the deliberate denial of due process of law to thousands of people held in secret interrogation centers built with U.S. dollars. Despite the censorship, taken together, the statements of the Bartons, McCloskey, and the anonymous special police chief I cited earlier are irrefutable. The CIA and its individual officers were responsible for any crimes the special police engaged in, including torture in PICs. As Jacques Klein observed, the CIA was an occupation force that functioned systematically like the Gestapo and SS Einsatzgruppen in France. Residual responsibility and systematic war crimes. Phoenix, the PRU, the PICs, and the special police were part of a system of repression the CIA designed and implemented in Vietnam for the political control of people. But was everything, from assassination to extortion, massacre, tiger cages, terror and torture, legitimate and justifiable? By 1971, the system's legality was questioned not just by anti-war activists, but by the House Subcommittee on Foreign Operations and Government Information. As usual, a whistleblower provided Congress with its ammunition. In late 1970, Army Intelligence Officer Barton Osborne gave an aide on the subcommittee's staff a copy of the training manual he had been issued at Fort Holabird. According to the aide, William Phillips, it showed that Phoenix policy was not something manufactured out in the field, but was sanctioned by the U.S. government. This was the issue, that it is policy. So we requested, through the Army's congressional liaison officer, a copy of the Holabird training manual, and they sent us a sanitized copy. They had renumbered the pages. This stab at disguising policy and avoiding responsibility is what had prompted McCloskey to visit the Phoenix Directorate in April 1971, in preparation for hearings to be held that summer. Phoenix training officer Colonel James Hunt was there with Cord's director Jake Jacobson and Phoenix director Mason. "And just as I was getting up to go to the platform to give my briefing," Hunt said, "Mason whispered into my ear, 'We gotta talk to them, but the less we say, the better.'" Well, the first question McCloskey asked was if anyone in the program worked for the CIA, and Mason denied it. He denied any CIA involvement. Jake, too. It bothered Hunt that Mason and Jacobson blatantly lied. It also bothered McCloskey, who returned to Washington and charged that Phoenix violated several treaties and laws. The legal basis for this charge was Article 3 of the Geneva Conventions, which prohibits the passing of sentences and the carrying out of executions without previous judgment pronounced by a regularly constituted court, affording all the judicial guarantees which are recognized as indispensable by civilized peoples. Article 3 also prohibits mutilation, cruel treatment, withholding medicine, for example, and torture. Having agreed to the conventions, Congress was aware of Article 3, but chose to ignore it. But a problem arose when the American ambassador to the International Committee of the Red Cross, ICRC, wrote a letter to Congress. In his 7 December 1970 letter, Imer Reinstedt said, "With respect to South Vietnamese civilians captured by U.S. forces and transferred by them to the authorities of the RVN, Republic of South Vietnam, the U.S. government recognizes that it has a residual responsibility to work with the government of Vietnam, GVN, to see that all such civilians are treated in accordance with the requirements of Article 3 of the conventions." To the consternation of America's war managers, Reinstedt's letter meant they could no longer dismiss the thousands of civilian detainees corralled in the Phoenix dragnet as an internal matter of the GVN. Reinstedt reasoned that by funding Phoenix, the Special Police, and the Directorate of Corrections, America automatically assumed residual responsibility for detainees, for as we know, without U.S. aid, there never would have been an RVN, or puppet governments in Iraq and Afghanistan. Reinstedt's letter implied that American war managers were war criminals, prompting CIA, State Department, and Pentagon lawyers to review Phoenix procedures and contest their illegality at the House Subcommittee on Foreign Operations and Government Information hearings in the summer of 1971. Luckily for them, on June 13th, the New York Times began printing excerpts from the Pentagon Papers, which by name deflected attention away from the CIA. Consequently, the public paid little attention when in July Congressman Reed asked Colby, "Are you certain that we know a member of the VCI from a loyal member of the South Vietnamese citizenry?" Colby said no, but that didn't stop Rob Simmons from throwing people in the PIC. On the contrary, the CIA, as part of the Interagency Vietnam Task Force, insisted the conventions afforded no protection to civilian detainees because nationals of a co-belligerent state are not protected persons while the state of which they are nationals has diplomatic representation in the state in whose hands they are. The CIA said that Article 3 applies only to sentencing for crimes and does not prohibit a state from interning civilians or subjecting them to emergency detention when such measures are necessary for the security or safety of the state. Skirting the issue of executions carried out without previous judgment pronounced by a regularly constituted court, it asserted that administrative detention procedures did not violate Article 3 precisely because they involved no criminal sentence. After the Bush regime began detaining suspects in Afghanistan, Iraq, and Guantanamo, legal scholar Jennifer Van Bergen and I examined its assertion that administrative detention was legal. Our conclusion was that where you find administrative detentions, you are likely to find torture. The connection exists, even where it is clear that investigations and screenings leading to such detentions are, as Bush's White House counsel Alberto Gonzalez put it, not haphazard but elaborate and careful, reasoned and deliberate. This conclusion derives from the faulty elements of administrative detention, the absence of human rights safeguards and normal legal guarantees such as due process, habeas corpus, fair trial, confidential legal counsel, and judicial review, vague and confusing definitions, standards, and procedures, inadequate adversarial procedural oversight, excessive executive branch power stemming from prolonged emergencies, the war on terror being the ultimate example, and the involvement of the CIA and other secret, thus unaccountable, executive branch agencies. When butchered in such a fashion, the judicial system is a charade and human rights are jeopardized. As William F. Schultz, executive director of Amnesty International, said, "This year we are witnessing not just a series of brutal but fundamentally independent human rights violations committed by disparate governments around the globe. This year we are witnessing something far more fundamental and far more dangerous. This year we are witnessing the orchestrated destruction by the United States of the very basis, the fragile scaffolding upon which international human rights have been built painstakingly, bit by bit by bit, since the end of World War II. The scaffolding upon which international human rights have been built has been destroyed forever by the Bush and Obama regimes by a carryover of practices first applied in Vietnam. The similarities between systematic repression in Vietnam and what's happening in the war on terror and its domestic flip side, homeland security, are not limited to policies and procedures, but include the psychological warfare campaigns that create the fear and thus the public support for the policies and procedures. The linkage between administrative detention, torture, and repressive police states is evident for all to see, but remains unrecognized due to the systematic censorship of information. The U.S. and Israel are at the forefront of this ominous development, manufacturing crisis after crisis to maintain a perceived national emergency with its corresponding emergency decrees that target the unprotected classes, and specifically U.S. citizens such as blacks and Muslims. Intelligence laws that permit spying on suspects without probable cause of criminal activity are secretly revised and expanded. Secret torture centers ensure confessions, and Star Chamber security courts are convened specifically to operate outside international law. And that's to say nothing of all the secrecy that surrounds Guantanamo. When backed into a corner, the government's public relations experts insist that torture is necessary to defend freedom. Cheney stood by it. Trump promised to bring back waterboarding and worse. That was a factor in his appeal. Behind this twisted logic are beastly impulses rooted in the dark side of the human psyche, the kind of impulses the CIA and the Mafia harness and use to achieve dominance. What differentiates the CIA and the Mafia, inter alia, is that the CIA more perfectly controls public institutions and information. The CIA, for example, owned and operated 3 newspapers in Saigon. One wonders how many it owns in America. Determined not to repeat the mistakes made in Vietnam, the Bush and Obama regimes prevented the media from publishing photos of dead U.S. soldiers returning from Iraq and Afghanistan. Like Bush, Obama uses censorship, disinformation, and propaganda to conceal the brutality of his policies and practices. We don't see the mutilated bodies after drone strikes. The purpose is to disguise criminal intent and practice. But any public official who engages in such a criminal conspiracy, including Rob Simmons, should be held responsible for the predictable result, which is why the nation needs a war crimes tribunal. At a bare minimum, Simmons could be tried for the human rights violation of denying due process. Due process is a human right recognized in international law to be enjoyed by all persons. But when Congressman Reed asked if civilian detainees had a right to counsel, Colby replied, no. Flabbergasted, McCloskey asked Colby, the administrative detention applies to those against whom there is insufficient evidence to convict. Isn't that right? Colby agreed. But, McCloskey blurted, the defendant informed against or identified has no right to appear in his own defense, no right to counsel, no right to confront his accusers, no right to see his dossier. Is that correct? That is correct, Colby said. That brings me to the real problem with the Phoenix program that I saw while I was there, McCloskey said. If the evidence is insufficient to convict a man, and also insufficient to show a reasonable probability that he may be a threat to security, then he may still be sent to the PIC. Congressman Reed added in utter exasperation, at least as shocking as the assassinations, torture, and drumhead incarcerations of civilians under the Phoenix program is the fact that in many cases the intelligence is so bad that innocent people are made victims. Reed produced a list, signed by the CIA's special branch advisor in Binh Dinh province, of VC cadre rounded up in February 1967. Reed said, it is of some interest that on this list, 33 of the 61 names were women, and some persons were as young as 11 and 12. Did the people of Vietnam feel the CIA was protecting them from terrorism? Cord's official Ted Jacquinet testified before Congress in 1971 that arrest without warrant or reason was a major complaint of the people of Da Nang. I have personally witnessed poor urban people literally quaking with fear when I questioned them about the activity of the secret police in the past election campaign. One fisherman in Da Nang, animated and talkative in complaining about economic conditions, clammed up in near terror when queried about the police, responding that he must think about his family. After many personal interviews in Vietnam on this subject, I came to the conclusion that no single entity, including the feared and hated Viet Cong, is more feared and hated than the South Vietnamese secret police. Jacquinet added, "In every province in Vietnam, there is a province interrogation center, a PIC, with a reputation for using torture to interrogate people accused of Viet Cong affiliations. Last year, the senior AID police advisor of Da Nang City Advisory Group told me he refused, after one visit, to ever set foot in a PIC again, because war crimes are going on in there. Another friend, himself a Phoenix advisor, was ultimately removed from his position when he refused to compile information on individuals who would, he felt, inevitably be targeted, however weak the evidence might be." Army intelligence officer Bart Osborne agreed, "I had no way of establishing the basis on which my agents reported to me suspected VCI. There was no cross-check. There was no investigation. There was no second opinion." Osborne added, "I never knew of an individual to be detained as a VC suspect who ever lived through an interrogation in a year and a half, and that included quite a number of individuals." "They all died?" Congressman Reed asked incredulously. "They all died," Osborne replied. "There was never any reasonable establishment of the fact that any one of those individuals was in fact cooperating with the VC. But they all died, and the majority were either tortured to death or things like thrown out of helicopters." At the end of the hearings, Representative McCloskey, John Conyers, Ben Rosenthal, and Bella Abzug stated their belief that "the people of the United States have deliberately imposed on the Vietnamese people a system of justice which admittedly denies due process of law. In so doing, we appear to have violated the 1949 Geneva Convention for the Protection of Civilian Peoples at the same time we are exerting every effort available to us to solicit the North Vietnamese to provide Geneva Convention protections to our own prisoners of war. Some of us who have visited Vietnam," they added, "share a real fear that the Phoenix program is an instrument of terror, that torture is a regularly accepted part of interrogation, and that the top U.S. officials responsible for the program at best have a lack of understanding of its abuses." They concluded that U.S. civilian and military personnel have participated for over 3 years in the deliberate denial of due process of law to thousands of people held in secret interrogation centers built with U.S. dollars. And they suggested that Congress owes a duty to act swiftly and decisively to see that the practices involved are terminated forthwith. It is as a participant in that genocidal endeavor that Rob Simmons should be tried as a war criminal. The making of a psychological warrior. Rob Simmons was trained and is highly skilled in the art of duplicity, of tricking people, and of torturing them into telling things that they didn't want to tell. He was also involved in setting up a hit team that went out and assassinated people in their own backyards. How did doing those things affect him? One would have to be inside a PIC and see the squalid conditions that the prisoners endured and hear their screams to understand the traumatic impact being in one of them for 18 months straight would have had on a 28-year-old CIA officer like Rob Simmons. When I met Simmons in September 1988, he not only exhibited signs of post-traumatic stress syndrome, he admitted having it. "People never resolve war experiences," he said with a lugubrious sigh. He seemed ready to explode and unleash the hatred he harbored against the anti-war left that sabotaged the Patriots. He raged at how the VC manipulated media in U.S., people like Walter Cronkite, who created the notion that Phoenix was an assassination program. A super patriot and the Barry bomb them into the Stone Age Goldwater mold, Simmons believes the First Amendment was never intended to be a free ride for individuals to say and do whatever they want. He reserves to himself, as one of the protected few, the right to determine when it is not okay for Black Lives Matter protesters to speak freely. He seamlessly structures his moral universe on a double standard in which the flag is a sacred symbol of liberty and burning it should be outlawed. In 2001, in one of his first votes as a congressman, he supported an anti-flag desecration amendment, and in June 2003 he voted yes on a constitutional amendment prohibiting flag desecration. When I wrote about him in 2000, I said his ideology, his activities at the PIC, and his actions on behalf of the CIA while staff director of the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence raised doubts about his fitness to govern in an open society within the framework of a constitution that guarantees due process to all Americans, including flag burners, anti-war protesters, and leftists. Based on what he did after Vietnam, I still feel that way. In the short term, he stayed in the CIA as an operations officer. Between 1975 and 1978, he ran a major operation that prevented the Taiwanese from obtaining material for a nuclear weapon. Sensitive files the Taiwanese needed were stolen, and attempts to buy materials were choked off. It was a feather in his coonskin cap. But as Simmons told author Joseph Persico, he got mad at Jimmy Carter's CIA director, Stansfield Turner, in what was called the Halloween Massacre of 1977, Turner fired an estimated 600 employees in the CIA's covert operations branch. I'd served overseas, risking myself and my family in some rough spots, and was damn poorly rewarded for it, Simmons whined, then expressed resentment at CIA critics on the left. People outside treated us like scum, like pariahs. His rant had the ring of a prepared script delivered by a practiced actor, and his ostensible exit in 1979 did not translate into severed relations with the CIA. On the contrary, Simmons kept his top-secret security clearance and went to work as a legislative assistant to neocon Senator John H. Chaffee at the Select Committee on Intelligence, while simultaneously obtaining a degree in public administration from Harvard. This period in his curriculum vitae has all the earmarks of a covert action. It looked to me like Simmons was being double-hatted, an arrangement through which an officer works under administrative cover for an organization while secretly taking orders from the CIA. Many junior military officers enter this relationship with the CIA while advancing to field officer grade and studying at the Command and General Staff College. It appeared to me that Simmons had a specific CIA assignment. While serving on Chaffee's staff, he helped draft and facilitate passage of the Intelligence Identities Protection Act. This legislation was ostensibly a result of the magazine's Counter-Spy and Covert Action Quarterly naming CIA officers. CIA dropout Philip A.G. and the aforementioned Bart Osborne were associated with the magazines. The CIA hated them with a purple passion, and largely through its unofficial public relations firm, the Association of Former Intelligence Officers, publicly but falsely blamed them for the murder of CIA officer Richard Welch in Athens in December 1975. The Intelligence Identities Protection Act makes it a crime to name CIA agents. John Kiriakou, who blew the whistle on CIA torture in 2007, is one of only two people convicted under it. Having proven his value as a moneymaker, Simmons in 1981 became staff director of the Republican-controlled Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. Reagan had been elected president, and Democrats were pushing for an investigation of William Casey, whom Reagan had nominated as director of the CIA. According to Persico, the committee's conservative chairman, Barry Goldwater, hired Simmons precisely to button up the investigation of Casey. And lo and behold, Simmons dutifully produced a truncated 5-page report describing Casey as not unfit to hold the job. There was no mention of Casey's associations with underworld character Robert Vesco, his connection with an ITT bribery scandal, and various other criminal escapades in self-aggrandizement. Simmons told Persico, Casey wasn't screwing widows or orphans. He was taking advantage of the law. Taking advantage is par for the course for the rich and powerful people Simmons serves, like Donald Rumsfeld. One day they're routing nerve gas to Saddam Hussein, the next day they're killing him, his family and followers, and stealing everything they own. The Democrats' fears about Casey were realized once he was confirmed as DCI. He reversed the Turner policies that Simmons hated and jumped in the stirrups of the counterterrorism network established by CIA careerists behind Carter's back. Casey used the network to bypass Congress and launch the Enterprise, the network of companies established by Major General Richard Secord to secretly sell arms to Iran through Israeli agents as a way of financing the illegal Contra war in Nicaragua. At Casey's direction, the CIA formed death squads, demolished an oil facility, and mined a harbor in Nicaragua, all violations of international law that had as their intent the terrorizing of civilians, the sort of thing former CIA dropout John Stockwell described as destabilization. Destabilization, said Stockwell, means hiring agents to tear apart the social and economic fabric of the country. It's a technique for putting pressure on the government, hoping they can make the government come to the U.S.'s terms, or that the government will collapse altogether and they can engineer a coup d'etat and have the thing wind up with their own choice of people in power. What we're talking about is going in and deliberately creating conditions where the farmer can't get his produce to market, where children can't go to school, where women are terrified inside their homes as well as outside, where government-administered programs grind to a complete halt, where the hospitals are treating wounded people instead of sick people, where international capital is scared away, and the country goes bankrupt. Of course, Stockwell added, they're attacking a lot more. And, of course, the CIA is doing this everywhere around the world, every day. You just don't hear about it on NPR. But Simmons knows how it works. That's why the CIA appears to have placed him on Senator Goldwater's staff. While in the prominent position of staff director of the Select Committee on Intelligence, Simmons was chaperoning fact-finding delegations to secret CIA installations for discussions not about the virtue of subverting U.S. laws and foreign nations, but on how best to go about it. Surrounded by old boys, he had his hands on the controls, but somehow failed to uncover Casey's self-sustaining, off-the-shelf drugs-for-guns apparatus that provided $1 million a month to the Contras. When the Iran-Contra scandal erupted, Simmons claimed that another CIA officer had deceived him, despite the fact that he'd talked to every major player and had read every secret document. But it was merely his administrative job to find out the truth and tell it to the American people. His prevailing operational job was to protect the secret old boy cabal that runs the CIA. Simmons rationalized Casey's deception of Congress as inconsequential. For people who served in war, author Bob Woodward said, Simmons thought that was the primary experience, real danger. Everything else paled by comparison. They had sent people to certain death, so to hustle some bucks was nothing. It was easy. To be criticized was nothing. So some judge or senator or reporter or cartoonist was beating on you. So what? You have served in war and survived. For such militants, steeped in the Homeric myth of the warrior hero, the ultimate test is murdering another man.